most never bathes, yet Englishmen still honour him. He is, after all, our king. Namontack feels no such obligation. The natives bathe quite often, even in cold weather. They have no fear of the English plague, only disdain for English stink.
Our chief Powhatan is a true king, says Namontack. He is powerful and honourable.
I am about to have my first chance to meet the great chief Powhatan. Captain Smith is taking me and Namontack, along with three other men, overland to Werowocomoco. We will bring an invitation to Chief Powhatan to come to Jamestown to receive gifts from King James and to be crowned. Captain Smith is angry at the whole plan, very angry.
Make an emperor into a prince? Ask an emperor to travel to receive gifts? I assure you, this will not sit well with Chief Powhatan,
he says.
He is king here in his own country. What right does King James have, from across an ocean, to make him his subject? Power is like weights in a balance. No one gains power without someone else losing power, and Chief Powhatan does not want to lose any of his power. It has been a long, hard road to peace with Chief Powhatan, but if he understands what this coronation means, it may well be the end of our peace.
Captain Newport refuses to budge. He is bound to carry out the orders from the Virginia Company, and so Captain Smith prepares for our journey to Werowocomoco. In the meantime, Miss Anne Burris is making quite an impression at Jamestown. She is almost always busy taking care of Mrs. Forrest, a very plump gentlewoman who hasn't figured out yet that life in Jamestown will be a lot harder than life in England. She is constantly making demands on Anne. Heat some water, wash these clothes, get supper on the table. Mrs. Forrest insists on having her meals in her cabin, with her husband instead of eating from the communal cookpot with the rest of us. During the rare moments Anne is not busy, she has every unmarried man in the colony trying to get her attention. Even Nathaniel, who is 16 by now, makes a fool of himself, strutting around in his armour, making a show of his musket and sword. There are at least 2 or 3 fistfights a day, and I've no doubt they are because of Miss Anne Burris. She is 14 years old, so she is of a marriageable age, and I suspect we will have a wedding before too long. One day Richard, Namontack, and I are sent to repair the fish nets and bring back the catch for supper. We are the only ones at the riverfront when Anne comes down to fill the buckets with water.
"Here, we can fill them," Richard offers. "We're already barefoot and wet."
He takes the buckets from her. Anne doesn't smile or say thank you. She just looks away. It is as if she has become afraid to look anyone in the eye, for fear they will try to court her. "We're just boys," I want to say. "We'll be your friends." While we fill the buckets, Anne walks to where some wildflowers are growing and picks a small bouquet of yellow, purple, and white. Then it seems as if my unspoken message has somehow gotten through, because she comes and sits down near us.
"A moment of peace," she says, and rubs her sore shoulders.
"Your mistress works you hard," I say. I do not add what I have been thinking for weeks. You'll never live through the winter if you stay so skinny and tired. And I don't ask what I have been suspicious about.
"Is your mistress eating some of your food rations?"
Anne shrugs.
"No harder than I worked in England," she says.
But I know this cannot be true.
"President Smith says if we don't work, we don't get to eat," says Richard. "I don't see your mistress doing much work, but by the looks of her, she does a whole lot of eating."
Richard, Namontack, and I laugh, but Anne scowls.
"Don't insult my mistress," she scolds.
But we can't help ourselves, and soon she breaks down and laughs with us. When we settle, Anne says,
"Mistress Forrest makes me work every moment because she is afraid I'll find a beau." She blushes as she says it. Her husband says I should marry, but she wants to keep me as her maid.
You have found this bow? Namantak asks.
Anne shakes her head.
She's found about 100 of them, Richard exclaims, and this starts us all laughing again.
Finally, Anne sighs. I'd better get back, or I'll get a beating for dawdling, she says.
We help her balance the yoke across her shoulders and lift the buckets of water. As I watch her walk back to the fort, I think that Mrs. Forrest should be made to do her own chores, and that Anne's best chance of making it through the winter will be to get away from that demanding woman. When she is gone, Richard asks,
Who do you think she'll marry if she gets permission?
Maybe your werowance, Captain Smith, Namantak suggests.
I shake my head.
He's the only unmarried man not courting her. He must be too busy for marriage.
As we repair the fishnets, we have fun guessing who Miss Anne Burris will pick if she gets permission to wed. I only hope she finds someone who will be kind to her and make sure she gets her full food rations. I have never dug a grave for a girl before, and I don't want to start now.
Chapter 20
Thus did they show their feats of arms, and others' art in dancing. Some other used their oaten pipe, and others' voices chanting. William Simons, E.D. The Proceedings.
The morning we are to leave for Werowocomoco, I am jittery with excitement. Namantak is, too. It will be his first time home since he went to England. He will have lots of stories to tell his people.
You will love my home, he says to me. It is...
I know, I interrupt him. It is much better than my home. We both laugh. Namantak collects the gifts he received in England. A red velvet cassock, which he says is not as warm as a deerskin mantle. A pewter chalice, which he says is not as good as a gourd to drink out of. And an ivory tooth scraper, which he refuses to use because he says the Indian way of cleaning his teeth, with a sassafras root, is much better. I gather my spoon and bowl and a water skin. We present ourselves to Captain Smith, each with a small bundle to carry. Captain Smith looks up from cleaning his musket.
Samuel, where is your sword? Where is your armor? Go back and get properly attired.
But I thought we were at peace with the Powhatans. I want to say. I know better than to argue with Captain Smith, so I simply go to my cabin and do as he says. At least he is not making me carry my heavy musket on the hike to Werowocomoco. When I get back to Captain Smith's cabin, the carpenter, John Layden, is sitting out front with his tools, working at making a small wooden chest. He is carving initials into the top of the chest. He already has an A, and as I watch, he finishes a B. Who is that for? I ask. He keeps his eyes cast down, intent on his work, and does not answer me. Then it dawns on me. I tip my head close to his. Is it for her? I whisper. He glances at me and I see he is afraid to tell me, afraid I will announce it and give the other men a chance to ridicule him. I look at the small chest. It is beautifully crafted out of cherry wood. A work of love. I watch him as he begins to carve a border around the initials. John Layden is a quiet man. He is sturdy and kind, and he is the only man who has decided to woo Miss Anne Burris with something other than bragging and strutting. I lean close again. She likes flowers, too, I say. He gives me a quick smile and continues his work. Captain Smith is ready to go. He carries his musket and has not one, but two bandoliers of gunpowder strung across his chest. His sword hangs at his side, and he is wearing full armor. He looks like he is going into battle, not like he is visiting someone to invite them to come get some presents. This crowning of Powhatan must truly be a bad idea. There are only six of us going. Me, Captain Smith, Namantak, and three soldiers. We hike over land for about 12 miles. When we come to the Pamunkey River, which separates us from Werowocomoco, we find a canoe in the rushes and use it to paddle across. When we reach the other side, I see nothing but the tall, grand trees with their leaves turning red and gold.
Come, says Namantak. Peaquag.
A worn footpath brings us into the woods, and soon I smell the smoke from cook fires. Namantak breathes deeply and smiles. He is coming home. We come to where the houses of Werowocomoco are gathered, straw-coloured rectangular houses with curved roofs. There are at least 20 of them scattered among the trees, with gardens in between. They are about the size of ours, but made of rushes woven together. Three small boys run out to greet us. Namantak lifts the littlest one in the air. He laughs and says in Algonquin,
"You grew so much while I was gone. You must have eaten a whole bear."
More people from the village come to see who has arrived. Captain Smith speaks with one of the elders. He tells him we have gifts for Chief Powhatan, brought from England. Will the great chief come to Jamestown to receive his gifts? The elder says that Chief Powhatan is in another village, 30 miles away. He will send for him immediately, but he will not arrive until tomorrow. I am relieved. We do not have to anger Chief Powhatan quite yet. It is beginning to get dark, and the air is filled with the chirping of crickets and cicadas. The elder motions for us to follow him, and he leads us to a field. Two young boys lay down mats for us to sit on, and then they build a fire. Are we being invited for supper? Are they about to start cooking on the fire, I wonder? We sit on the mats, and various people from the village come to sit near us, a few old men and women, many children, and young warriors. They are all silent, their faces expectant, as if they are waiting for something to happen. But no one brings food to cook on the fire. My stomach begins to churn. What is going on? What are they expecting to happen? I am glad I have my sword, but what are they going to do to us? Captain Smith sits on the mat next to me. His eyes are wary, and I know that he too suspects this might be a trap. I touch his sleeve. What are they doing? I whisper. Suddenly, shrieking and howling erupt from the forest, the same battle cries I heard the night James was killed. I leap to my feet and pull out my sword, ready to fight and slash. Captain Smith draws his sword. He seizes an old man sitting near us and holds the sword to his throat. Our soldiers aim their muskets into the dark forest. The howling comes closer, louder. Our attackers would be upon us any moment. Out of the shadows, a little girl comes running. She rushes up to us and stands bravely in front of the loaded muskets. It is Pocahontas. I promise no harm will come to you, she says, holding out her hands, palms up. If I am wrong, you may kill me. Captain Smith lets go of the old man. He translates what Pocahontas has said for the soldiers, and they slowly lower their muskets.
All right,
Captain Smith says, still looking wary. Pocahontas recognizes me and smiles. She comes to me and Captain Smith, and gives us that same look of expectancy I've been seeing all evening. Just watch, she says. Then in English she adds, you like. I grin. Captain Smith must have taught her some English words during her visits to our fort and his visits to her village. She takes our hands, pulls us both down onto our mats, and settles in between us. The fire casts a moving light. Into that firelight leaps a form. Is it a buck? I blink. It is a woman. She is wearing the horns of a buck. Another woman leaps into the light, then another, and another. All dancing, shrieking their battle cries, their bodies painted white and black and red. Some wear box horns on their heads, and each carries a weapon. One a club, another a sword, another a bow and arrows. The young women leap and whirl around the fire, their battle cries now mixing with the music of drums and rattles. They bring the night alive with their warriors' dance. I watch, spellbound. It is magic. The music and dancing lasts for at least an hour. Then the women run off into the darkness of the forest, shrieking the same as when they came. There is a moment of hushed silence. Then everyone starts talking, laughing, with children running and playing, and everyone getting up from their mats. Pocahontas looks at me, her eyes glowing. "Did you like it?" she asks in Algonquin. I nod enthusiastically. "Wow," I say. This is a new Algonquin word I learned from Namontack. Wow is their word for wonder and awe, and it is definitely the best word to describe what I have seen. I have heard about the masquerades in England, with their grand costumes and music and acting, but only nobles are allowed to see them. Now I have seen a New World masquerade while sitting next to a princess. With torches lighting our way, Pocahontas leads us back into the village to one of the houses. There, the young women dancers join us, still in their costumes of body paint. They all act as if they are in love with Captain Smith and our soldiers. They crowd around them, giggling and saying in English, "Love you, not me? Love you, not me?" I raise my eyebrows at Pocahontas. "Who teach them that?" I ask. She gives me an impish look and shrugs. I smell something delicious and turn to see several older women bringing in platters of food. There are large wooden bowls of steaming beans, peas and squash, platters of roasted fish and venison, baskets of bread and fruit. It is a feast. I eat until I can't stuff in another bite. When Namontack sees me yawning, he takes me by the shoulders and steers me toward the door.
"You will sleep in my house tonight," he says.
Outside, the night air is brisk, but when we enter Namontack's house, it is toasty warm from a fire in the middle of the dirt floor. The smoke gathers in the high ceiling and escapes through a hole in the roof. Lining the walls, there are platforms made with poles, reed mats, and skins. I see that Namontack's brothers, the three little boys who greeted him when we arrived, are already asleep on the platforms. He points to where I will sleep, next to the smallest boy. He gives me a deerskin blanket to keep me warm. As I lie on the bed, I can still hear the talking and laughing coming from the house where the feast is going on. Namontack is right, I think. His home is much better than Jamestown. There is more food and more joy to be had in one night here than in a whole year in Jamestown. Thomas Savage only stayed for a little while in Werowocomoco. Why did he not beg to be allowed to stay forever? I wish I could come here to live. I would learn the Algonquin language even better, and I would be able to trade and help the colony. Namontack could teach me to make a bow and arrows and to shoot straight. I could hunt and help to feed us. I wonder if this is what Reverend Hunt means about making decisions out of love. Love for our newfound Indian friends. Love for our fragile New World colony. I remember when we first landed in Virginia, and again the night of the Indian raid, how I thought I hated all of the natives, and I wanted our men to shoot them and kill them. Those thoughts seem so strange to me now. Now that Namontack has become my friend, and Chief Powhatan has rescued us from cold and starvation, and the Princess Pocahontas has treated us as her countrymen. This new world is a good place to live, I think, as long as we live in peace with the Powhatan people. Then I remember how Captain Smith dressed as a warrior to bring news of the coronation to Chief Powhatan, how he said this news would not sit well with the chief, and I wonder how long the peace and the love will last. Chapter 21
If your king have sent me presents, I also am a king, and this is my land. 8 days I will stay to receive them. Your father, Captain Newport, is to come to me, not I to him, nor yet to your fort. Neither will I bite at such a bait. Chief Powhatan, quoted in William Simons, E.D., The Proceedings.
It is morning when I see Wahun Sunacock, the great Powhatan, for the first time. He is tall and imposing, strong and regal. He wears a necklace of a large piece of copper, and many strings of beads. If copper and beads are the Powhatan gold and jewels, then he must truly be wealthy. Captain Smith delivers his message. Will the great chief come to Jamestown to receive his gifts from King James? I see immediately that Captain Smith was right. An emperor should not be invited to come to another town to receive gifts. Chief Powhatan's eyes flash with anger.
Your king has sent me presents, he demands. I also am a king, and this is my land.
He splays his arms and fingers to show this is all his land.
I will wait here 8 days to receive the gifts. Captain Newport is to come to me, not I to him.
On the hike back to Jamestown, Captain Smith stomps his anger into the woodland path.
They know nothing, he shouts. Those Virginia Company investors sit in their velvet chairs and dream up what they want to accomplish here. They know nothing of the reality of what is here, and they're going to get us killed. They are idiots!
I keep my eyes on the ground, and the soldiers do the same. None of us wants to say a word to Captain Smith when he is this angry.
Who ever heard of making an emperor into a prince?
He continues. Yet that is what they are trying to do. He kicks a fallen branch out of his way.
No good will come of this. Mark my words, no good at all.
Back in Jamestown, Captain Smith delivers Chief Powhatan's message. Captain Newport frowns, but he is still determined to obey the orders from the Virginia Company. Chief Powhatan must be crowned a prince under King James. Captain Newport says he will travel to Werowocomoco to accomplish this task. Though the trip is only 12 miles across land, it is much longer by boat. Powhatan's gifts, an English bed, furniture, a copper pot, a wash basin and pitcher, a red cloak, shoes, and that troublesome crown are loaded onto a barge for the 100-mile trip down the James River, or the Powhatan River, depending on who you are talking to, into the Chesapeake Bay and up the Pamunkey River to Werowocomoco. Captain Newport and his men return from the coronation a week later. Captain Smith does not even ask them how it all went. He is still fuming. The soldiers who were there tell us the story. Chief Powhatan was asked to kneel to receive his crown. He pretended to not understand. Captain Newport demonstrated the kneeling over and over again until he looked like a marionette on strings and people began to snicker. Still, Chief Powhatan acted as if he did not understand. He absolutely would not kneel. Captain Smith nods smugly when he hears this.
He understood perfectly,
he says,
and he refused to lower himself.
Finally, Captain Newport ordered 2 soldiers to push down hard on Chief Powhatan's shoulders. This made the chief take 1 quick tripping step, and in that moment they placed the crown on his head. Then they shot off a round of musket fire to celebrate. Chief Powhatan was now officially a subject of King James I of England.
He is happy with his new position,
Captain Newport says.
He gave me his mantle as a gift in return.
But another soldier fills us in on the rest.
He gave the mantle, and it is a beauty, because he really liked the bed and washbasin, copper pot, and what not. But do you know what else he gave Captain Newport? A pair of worn-out, sweaty, smelly old moccasins. I'll bet he's spitting them, too. That's what he thinks of that crown. Let me tell you, Chief Powhatan is a proud emperor. He does not want to be a prince under our King James.
Especially not after he has heard from Namantak that King James is a short, flabby, weak man with no teeth and the strongest body odour in London. I have a bad feeling in the pit of my stomach. It has all been a big mistake, a mistake we cannot undo. What will happen now? I ask Captain Smith.
Trouble,
he says, his anger smouldering.
Trouble that we will have to bear, while the fools who gave these orders sit in their comfortable homes in London, and while Captain Newport sails safely back to England.
The first thing we get is not trouble, but a wedding. Anne has permission to marry, and she has said yes to John Leyden. I am convinced she made a good choice. One night, when it rained so hard, all of our cabins were flooding. John Leyden was outside Master and Mistress Forrest's cabin, where Anne lives, digging a trench instead of trying to save his own cabin from the flood. I believe he will be a good husband to her. We gather in the chapel, Anne in her burgundy Sunday petticoat and yellow bodice, and John in his just-washed shirt with a blue doublet. Reverend Hunt performs the service, and we have a good meal afterward, with several chickens sacrificed for the celebration. The trees surround us with their fall leaves in blazes of red and orange and yellow, as if they too are celebrating the first English wedding in the New World. Reverend Hunt is in good spirits for the wedding, but he has been feeling poorly off and on for months now. It is as if the summer sickness never left him. He has headaches and fevers that sometimes send him to his bed. A few days after the wedding, Reverend Hunt takes to his bed again. Richard takes good care of him, but I also check on him often to see if he needs water or food or other comfort. I wonder if there is something, some food or herb or medicine, that I can bring him that will heal him this time, the way the eggs and meat and wine healed him before. One day, when I check on him, he asks me for some water. His hands shake as he takes the goblet from me. He drinks, then looks me in the eye.
"Samuel, you will not always be a servant," he says. "You will do something far greater than that."
I am surprised by this sudden announcement. I shake my head. I am an orphan, the son of dead peasants. Of course I will always be a servant. What else could I be, I wonder?
"You must learn from what you see around you," he says. "Learn from Captain Smith, President Smith. Do you know why he is well-liked as president, while President Wingfield and President Ratcliffe were not?"
I know the answer, because I have already thought about it. "It is because Captain Smith cares about all of us," I say. "The other leaders cared only for their own comfort and their own gain, and for the gain of a few of their friends." Reverend Hunt nods.
"Good. You are already learning. This is important for you to remember, because I will not always be here to remind you."
He lies back down and closes his eyes. "But if I will not always be a servant, what will I be?" I ask. "Could I become a soldier? Even an officer like Captain Smith?" Reverend Hunt smiles with his eyes closed.
"You will see," he says. "Remember what we have talked about here, and remember that you will always know the right decision, because it is when you choose from love."
He looks as if he has talked enough. I take a rag, wring it out in a bowl of cool water, and lay it on his forehead. He is so pale and seems so weak, it is the worst I have seen him. My chest feels heavy with sadness. Reverend Hunt was the first person I opened my heart to after it was closed up tight when my mum died. I can't stand to see life slipping away from him like this. I wonder if I might lay my hands on his head and pray, and keep his soul from leaving his body, the way he did for me many months ago. But I realize, if God is ready to take Reverend Hunt up to heaven, it is not my business to try and stop him. "Would you like some supper?" I ask Reverend Hunt quietly. He shakes his head slightly. I touch his hand and leave him to rest. Reverend Hunt does not leave his bed again. Richard and I keep a vigil, one or the other of us checking on him each hour. Finally, he stops asking for food or water and wants only to lie still. I know it is my last chance to speak to him. I go in the evening, light a candle, and kneel by his bed. "Reverend Hunt," I whisper. He opens his eyes for a moment and nods, and I know he is listening. What do I want to say? Don't leave. Please stay. Pray for another miracle. I shake my head to stop these thoughts. He is leaving, I tell myself firmly. You can't stop it. Reverend Hunt, thank you for teaching me, I say. I force myself to talk past the lump in my throat. Thank you for treating me like I was worth something. The day we bury Reverend Hunt, it is rainy and cold. My feet sink into the mud at the gravesite. Richard stands with me, both of us silent. They shoot off the cannons in Reverend Hunt's honor. A great man has gone to his reward in heaven. Chapter 22.
Captain Smith, you shall find Powhatan to use you kindly, but trust him not, for he hath sent for you only to cut your throats. Chief of the Wereskoyaks, quoted in William Simons, E.D., The Proceedings.
Our trouble starts when winter sets in. If we had more skilled farmers and hunters, and if we all worked at farming and hunting, we might be able to produce enough food to get us through the winter. But as it is, our men are kept busy searching for gold, digging sassafras, and making clapboard, glass, pitch, tar, and soap ashes to ship back to England, in the hopes that something in the lot will make a profit for the Virginia Company. And to make things worse, when Captain Newport leaves in December, he takes a lot of our food stores with him, saying he and his sailors will need them for the long voyage home. At least he takes Captain Ratcliffe as well, and rids us of him. When our barrels are close to empty, Captain Smith goes to trade with the natives for grain. But he comes back empty-handed. Chief Powhatan has commanded all of his tribes not to trade with us.
"He is wielding his power," says Captain Smith. "He is showing us that the crowning ceremony angered him, and that his power is not diminished by it. We will see what else he plans to do."
We are allowed one cup of grain for each person each day. I am always hungry. I often think of the feast at Werowocomoco, and wish I was there again. Richard and I dig up sassafras root to chew on to ease our hunger. Then we talk about food, trying to use our minds to fill our bellies. My mum used to make Yorkshire pudding at Christmas time, I say, with the crust just a little brown and loads of gravy. Richard closes his eyes, imagining. "And remember All Saints' Day at the orphanage?" he asks. "When we had stew with enough meat in it so everyone got some?" We talk about the birds and fish we roasted on Nevis, and I tell him again about the mounds of peas, squash, and venison at the Werowocomoco feast. Soon our jaws are tired from chewing on the sassafras roots, and for a time our bellies are fooled into thinking we have eaten. Then, one day, we have good news, or what seems like good news. Two natives arrive to tell us that Chief Powhatan is ready to trade. He will give us food if we bring him what he wants. A grindstone, a rooster, and a hen, copper, beads, 50 swords, several muskets, and workmen to build him an English-style house. He knows we are hungry enough that Captain Smith might well give him all he wants, including the weapons. President Smith rubs his forehead and says quietly,
"We are desperate for the food."
To the messengers in Algonquin he says,
"Tell Chief Powhatan we come. Give things he wants."
But as the messengers walk away, he says in English,
"Except the guns and swords. I will throw in some extra gifts instead."
I smile. Watching the battle of wills between Captain Smith and Chief Powhatan is like watching the dance of a sword fight between two proud, powerful men. We load up two barges and the Discovery for the trip to Werowocomoco. We hope to bring all three of the vessels back laden with food. The first night we stop at the Werowocomoco village and are welcomed as guests. Chief Sassantecum shares his pipe of tobacco with Captain Smith, and shares some advice as well. I listen hard to understand the Algonquin words.
"Chief Powhatan will treat you kindly, but do not trust him,"
he says.
"He has sent for you only to slit your throats."
Captain Smith does not seem surprised, and I realize he has already guessed that this might be a trap.
"We keep guns ready,"
he says in his choppy Algonquin. Then he looks at me.
"I leave boy with you?"
he asks Chief Sassantecum.
"I send messenger to him. If I dead, boy go to Jamestown, tell others."
This chills me to my bones. I want to object, to tell Captain Smith not to go. Why is he willingly walking into a trap? We are surviving on our grain, I want to tell him. Captain Newport will be back soon. Let us all return to Jamestown tomorrow and wait for the supply ship. But I don't say anything. It is not my place. Chief Sassantecum agrees. Captain Smith and the other men will go on to Werowocomoco in the morning. I will stay in the Werowocomoco village and wait. If Captain Smith is killed, I will return to Jamestown to bring the news. The next morning I watch the Discovery sail away with Captain Smith at her helm. I wonder if it will be the last time I see him. I push down sadness. I have already lost Reverend Hunt. I don't want to lose Captain Smith as well. I tell myself that he is wily and smart, and will not easily fall into Chief Powhatan's trap. The Werowocomoco village is a busy place, and I want to do my share of the work. But when I try to help two girls with their pounding of corn into meal, Kenta, Chief Sassantecum's son, pulls me away. "That work is for the women to do," he says. "I will show you men's work." He takes me into the forest. There is a thin layer of snow on the dead leaves, and my feet crunch loudly on them. He stops and looks at me, frowning. "You are very loud," he says. He inspects my shoes. "My mother will make you moccasins." He looks around, finds a sapling that seems to be just right for what he is searching for, and cuts it down with his hatchet. "I will teach you how to make a bow and arrows," he says. Working with wood and stone is a good way to keep my mind off what might be happening to Captain Smith. Kenta teaches me how to peel the bark off the sapling, cut notches for the bowstring, and string it with strong gut. We make several arrow shafts from straight, thin wood. He shows me how to make an arrowhead, chipping a piece of rock until it is the right shape. It is a slow process, and I ruin several pieces of rock before I get it right. But finally, I am able to make my first arrowhead. Then I tie it to a shaft and balance the shaft with feathers so that it will shoot straight. When we grow hungry, we go to the communal cook fire. There we find a large clay pot filled with hominy and venison stew, fish on the grill and bread baking in the hot ashes on the ground. "Eat," says Kinkta. He tears off a piece of bread and uses an oyster shell to scoop stew right out of the pot. I do the same. It is delicious. This is what I have seen people do all day. Just come up to the pot and take what they want to eat. I realize that they have no meal times, no rationing of food, and I think that these Powhatan people must be the wealthiest people on the earth. A young woman comes to put a new loaf of bread in the ashes and to stir the pot of stew. She wears a kind of apron made of deerskin that hangs down to her knees. Her arms, face, and legs have colorful tattoos of patterns, flowers, fruits, and snakes. Her black hair is plaited into one long braid, hanging down to her hips. She smiles shyly at me. How strange I must look to her in my English clothes. No messenger comes that day, or the next. I don't know if this is good news or bad. I have no choice but to wait. At sunrise, I go with Kinkta down to the river, where he bathes in the frigid water. I stay, shivering on the shore. Kinkta sprinkles a bit of tobacco on the river, closes his eyes, and lifts his hands, and I know he is praying. This is what Namantak did each morning when he lived with us in Jamestown. The days go by, and I learn more about men's work, which is mostly about hunting and fishing. I am also careful to learn which chores are women's work, so that I will not embarrass myself again by trying to do any of it. Planting, weeding, harvesting, making clay pots, cooking, making clothes. It is all for the girls and women to do. Kinkta teaches me how to make a knife by chipping a piece of rock until it is sharp, then tying it with gut onto a short stick. He gives me a buckskin pouch and shows me how to hang it from my waist with a leather strap. My knife fits nicely inside. I continue to make my arrows, chipping the arrowheads and tying the feathers, until I have enough to go hunting. Kinkta shows me how to weave a case so that I can carry my arrows on my back. He has me practice with my bow and arrows and a target until I can shoot straight. It snows. Kinkta says this will make hunting even easier because we will see the animals' tracks in the snow. I have my new moccasins and I walk carefully, heel to toe, the way he has shown me, trying to be as silent as he is. I am concentrating so hard that at first I do not notice someone else who has been walking quietly in the forest. Then suddenly I look up and see him. "Namantak!" I cry out. I am very glad to see him. Then, when I realize why he has come, I am filled with fear. He is the messenger from Werowocomoco. I stand, gripping my bow, waiting for the bad news. Namantek smiles.
"Do not look so worried, Samuel. Your master sends good wishes."
I groan with relief. Then I am confused. "Why have you come and not Captain Smith?" I ask him in English. He answers me in Algonquin. I am in his world now.
"Captain Smith says you will stay with the Werowocomocos through the winter. You will learn more of the language and eat well."
Kinkta joins us. He and Namantak exchange the greeting of countrymen. With one fist, each taps first his own chest, then forehead, and then taps the other boy's chest and forehead. "Come," says Kinkta, You must be hungry after your journey. We will hunt later.
We sit with Namentak at the communal cook fire as he eats. I form my question in Algonquin. Chief Powhatan make trap? I ask him. Now that I have heard the good news, I am ready to hear the whole story.
Yes,
Namentak says,
but your werowance is quick as a rabbit. The trap did not catch him.
He grins. He likes Captain Smith as much as I do. In between mouthfuls, Namentak tells us what happened. Captain Smith and his men arrived in Werowocomoco and were treated kindly. They traded for lots of corn, but by the time their boats were loaded up, the tide was out and the boats couldn't move. They had to spend the night in Werowocomoco, staying in one of the houses. Just after dark, Captain Smith heard a sound at the door. It was Pocahontas. Her eyes were wide with terror.
"You must go," she said. "In a little while, my father's men will bring you food. As soon as you put your weapons down and begin to eat, they will slit your throats with your own swords. And if they don't succeed, there will be a bigger attack later."
She begged them to leave right away. She was crying. She knew that if she was caught warning Captain Smith, her father would have her put to death. She may have been play-acting the first time, I think, but this time she really did risk her life to save Captain Smith. The tide was still too low for them to leave. Within an hour, 10 strong warriors came with platters of food, just like Pocahontas had said they would. The warriors said the slow matches on the Englishmen's guns were smoking up the room, making them sick, and they should put them out. But Captain Smith just said,
"Oh, we don't mind the smoke."
Then he made the warriors taste all of the food to make sure it wasn't poisoned. Captain Smith and his men ate their supper with their guns smoldering and ready. "And later, big attack?" I ask. Namentak tells us how the Englishmen kept up a guard half the night, standing with their muskets ready. There never was an attack. At midnight the tide had risen enough to move the boats, and they left. So Captain Smith and his men are safe, and they have taken corn back to Jamestown. "Thank you. Good news," I say to Namentak. It has begun to snow again, and Namentak is invited to stay the night. He sleeps in the family house with Kainta and me. The next day the three of us go hunting. We walk quietly through the white forest, stalking rabbits. We see one. Even I have been quiet enough not to startle it. Kainta and Namentak both look at me. They want me to shoot, to have a chance to make my first kill. Silently, I pull out an arrow and string it on my bow. I make my breath even and slow, so that it will not affect my shot. I watch the rabbit as it hops along the undergrowth, looking for food. I pull back the bowstring and aim. Then I let the arrow fly. There's a whoosh and a thud. The arrow hits its mark. The hare lies still. Blood seeps out where my arrow has entered its side, staining the snow bright red. Kainta claps me on the back. "You have learned well," he says. I am still amazed at what I have done.
"Go take your prize and give thanks to the god Okeus for your meat," says Namentak.
I tie the rabbit's hind feet to a piece of gut and hang it around my waist. We hunt some more, and the other two boys also get rabbits. The winter day is short. When the sun sinks down, casting long shadows over glittering snow, it is time to return to the village. I use my knife to cut open the rabbit's abdomen and clean out its entrails, and to peel the rabbit skin away from the meat. My rabbit, which I have killed myself with the weapon I made myself, becomes part of the communal stew that evening. It makes me feel proud and strong. Namentak goes home to Werowocomoco, and I stay at the Werascoyac village,
as Captain Smith has prescribed. Cainter and I do more hunting. He shakes his head when he sees me trying to keep my hair, which is getting quite long, out of my way. He asks his mother to cut my hair for me. She takes two mussel shells and grates away the hair on the right side of my head, down to the scalp. It pinches and pulls, but I keep still. On the left side she leaves it long, and she cuts a ridge of short hair down the middle of my head, so that my hair looks very much like the other men and boys.
"There," says Cainter, "now it will not get caught in your bowstring."
When the winds of February blow cold, I wear a mantle of deerskin. During the March thaw, I kill my first wild turkey. Cainter ties two of its feathers into the long side of my hair. In late April, when the mosquitoes, flies, and gnats come out, Cainter shows me how a layer of bear grease mixed with a powder of red pecan root keeps the bugs away. It also makes my skin red. I no longer look very much like an English boy. One day, we boys are playing a game that is much like English football. We have a goal at each end of a field, and we kick a ball made of skins, trying to score by kicking the ball into the other team's goal. I have finally gotten tired of sweating in my slops and long-sleeved shirts during these games, and have let Cainter's sister make me a buckskin breechcloth to wear. The red pecan dye protects my back, chest, arms, and legs from insects and the burning of the sun, and my moccasins protect my feet for running. The right side of my hair has been newly shaved by Cainter's mother, and the left side of my hair is quite long, almost to my shoulder. I've added a few shells to the feathers as ornaments. As we play, I hear a call of "Wingapo!" spoken with an English accent. I stop running. I've almost forgotten what English speech sounds like. What I see takes my breath away. It is Richard, Nathaniel, Henry, Abram, and several others. They look thin and wan. They are walking toward us. Richard calls out, speaking Algonquin, as if he has memorized just what to say. "Captain Smith send. Need eat. Find English boy Samuel." I sputter. "Richard," I call to him. "It's me." Richard's eyes go wide and his mouth drops open.
"By God, he's turned into a savage," Henry says.
I ignore Henry and go to greet Richard and the others. The Indian boys gather around us. "Are you here to bring me back?" I ask, still not understanding why they have come. Richard shakes his head.
"We're here to stay for a while to eat. Rats got into the grain. There were so many of them, they looked like maggots squirming in the barrels. We have almost nothing left. So President Smith has sent us different places. Some he sent up the river to live on oysters, some down the river to Point Comfort to live on fish, and some to friendly tribes. We got sent here. We have copper to pay our way." I translate as best I can for Cainter. He nods and says he will go tell his father that they are here.
"So," Richard eyes me curiously, "did that stuff just get stuck in your hair, or did you put it there on purpose?"
I sock him playfully in the arm, and we both laugh. I think of how I want to teach him what I have learned, how to make snares to catch beavers, otters, and squirrels, how to build a fire in a canoe at night so the fish will be mesmerized and come close so we can spear them, how to find mushrooms and roots and berries that are good to eat. I know that with the knowledge I've gained from living with the Warris Koyaks, we don't ever have to be hungry again.
Chapter 23.
What will it avail you to take that by force you may quickly have by love, or to destroy them that provide you food? What can you get by war when we can hide our provisions and fly to the woods? whereby you must famish by wronging us, your friends. Chief Powhatan, quoted in William Simon's ED, The Proceedings.
If trouble can multiply like rats in grain, then that is what our troubles do in 1609. By midsummer, Captain Smith sends word to the Warriscoyack village that we are to return to Jamestown. A ship has arrived, so there is food. There is also much work to be done. We need to build houses for the new colonists. When I get to Jamestown, I am stunned by what I see. The Virginia Company has sent not only men, but families with women and children. Richard and I watch as two women meet in front of a cabin to talk for a moment. One holds a baby on her hip, and the other has a little boy of 4 or 5 clinging to her skirts. I shake my head. How could they do this? I wonder out loud to Richard. It must be because no one is allowed to say anything bad about Jamestown in their letters back home, says Richard. I nod. The Virginia Company lies to them about how it is paradise here and how they will find mountains of gold, and they believe the lies. The little boy sees us and grins around the thumb he has stuck in his mouth. I wonder if he will live through the winter. It is strange for me to be living with Englishmen again instead of Warriscoyacks. Not even Namantak is with us any more. It is hard to get used to eating only at mealtimes and having my food rationed again. I cut the long side of my hair and go back to wearing English clothes. I keep my bow, arrows, and moccasins in a corner of my cabin, but I still wear the buckskin carrying pouch with my knife inside, hanging at my waist. Some nights I dream that I am back in the Warriscoyack village, or hunting with Kainta and Namantak in a quiet, snow-filled forest. It is good to see Anne and John Leyden again. When I first see Anne, my jaw drops, and I think John must have been giving her all of his food rations along with her own, because she is very